This is the Poll, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode, The Memory of Land. How do you memorialize a place that holds a complicated history, where the land contains different meanings for different people? To some, the place we're about to visit is a famous battleground that speaks to courage and taking a stance against exploitation. To others, it represents a valuable resource that has provided wealth and jobs for decades. Irina Zhorov has more.
There's this mountain in southern West Virginia. It's just under 2,000 feet tall, dense with trees, filled with the trill of birds. In some ways, it's like any of the other pretty ridges in the vast Appalachian ranges. But this mountain, it's got a history.
It's a history that was told in whispers.
A history of bloodshed.
It's impossible to go up here and go around with a metal detector and not find bullets. A lot of bullets. Just 5-10 minutes, and it's bullets, bullets, bullets.
I'm here at Blair Mountain with Chuck Keeney. He teaches history at Southern West Virginia Community and Technical College. There's a metal gate blocking a dirt road. This is private land, so we climb over the gate.
Or under. There's another way of doing it.
And walk some 50 feet into the woods.
So, here we are.
Tell me what happened here.
Well, this is the southern point of the Battle of Blair Mountain. This was August 31st through September the 4th, 1921.
100 years ago, a battle raged here between coal miners and coal company loyalists. But before this battle, there were rising tensions and conflict. Back then, early 20th century Appalachia, miners in these southern West Virginia coal fields lived in company towns. They were dependent on their bosses for every necessity. Their homes, their food. Pay was low. Living and working conditions were deplorable. The United Mine Workers Union attempted to organize miners here, but the coal companies fought back, often violently. In a series of clashes now called the Mine Wars, both union and company supporters were killed. By 1921, tensions were coming to a head. Miners in Mingo County, south of Blair, had joined the union. In retaliation, the company had evicted them from their homes.
The miners themselves had been rounded up. They were being kept in pens. State police had cut off the food supplies, so the families were starving.
Then a union sympathizer named Sid Hadfield, a hero to the miners, was brazenly murdered by private detectives who worked for the coal companies. It was broad daylight, and Sid's wife was by his side. Tensions boiled over.
After that, the miners took matters into their own hands.
1 week after the murder, Frank Keeney, the leader of West Virginia's United Mine Workers chapter, and, by the way, Chuck's great-grandfather, gave a series of speeches to rally miners in the coal fields.
He was the guy that told them the only way you can get your rights is with the high-powered rifle, then told them to go home and await the call to march. And he's the one who sent out the call to march.
The plan was to march more than 50 miles from Charleston, West Virginia, to Mingo County in support of the evicted miners. Blair Mountain, in a county controlled by Don Chafin, a notoriously anti-union sheriff, sat in the way.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
The sheriff recruited some 3,000 law enforcement officers, coal company guards, and civilians. They entrenched up high on Blair Mountain with machine guns. The miners, 10 to 15,000 of them, armed with rifles or whatever weapons they could find, approached from below. The sheriff's army rained down bullets on the miners. Some people claim 1 million rounds were spent over those 5 days. Chuck braves some poison ivy to check out the terrain from a bank.
You can see why you would choose this place to defend.
It's really, really steep.
It's hard to walk up the hill, much less if you had machine guns bearing down on you. But it's so important, the place itself is so important, because you really can't understand the magnitude of what was happening until you're up here and you stare down the slope. and you think what would motivate individuals to charge up this hill against machine guns, you have to ask yourself, what would it take to get you to do something like that? And you begin to see the magnitude of the conflict and the intensity of it.
The Battle of Blair Mountain is the largest insurrection in U.S. history, second to the Civil War. There isn't a clear record of how many people died in the battle. Officially, it's at least 16, though some put it closer to 100 people. The federal government had to send in troops to end the conflict. It's a pivotal yet largely forgotten event in our country's labor movement. And the only thing that marks it is a small silver plaque at the foot of the mountain.
It was kind of weird growing up, knowing that there was a war fought here and nobody knew about it and there's no monuments to it. And it's just whispers. And as I grew older and I began to slowly comprehend the magnitude of the history and the significance of it, I was like, we don't need to whisper this history. We need to shout it from the mountaintops.
Memorializing tragedy is complicated. We build museums, collect artifacts. That's one way to do it. But events happen in places, and places are part of the story.
I think maybe one way to think about it is an anchor, that the place itself, the land, anchors memory.
Ken Foote is a geographer at the University of Connecticut. He started thinking about the role of place in memorializing historic events in the 1980s, on a visit to Salem, Massachusetts. By then, the town was already commercializing the history of the Salem witch trials into a kitschy tourist industry. But there was no real substantive memorial to that same history. No real reckoning with it.
And that sense of shame that was attached to killing their neighbors hung over the town for a long time, and there was no sense that the site itself should be preserved or commemorated whatsoever.
Ken became curious about other sites of historical tragedy in the U.S. What happened to them? He started investigating. And he found that sometimes, usually when a community felt a great sense of loss, or perhaps some positive meaning after an event, like community heroism, there was commemoration. Think 9/11. But that was rare.
Most sites of violence and tragedy, nothing happens. They're what I call rectified. The places themselves are put back to use. There's little sense of a lesson or meaning to them.
Or there's even a deliberate effort to forget what happened at a site. But here's the thing. Human lives and memory get embedded in landscape like fossils. And usually, it's only a matter of time before they're uncovered, interpreted, and contested.
There's going to be an emotional connection in some way.
This is Allison James. She's a lecturer at the University of Virginia School of Architecture. She's interested in cultural landscape preservation.
The ways in which we shape landscape, or the ways in which landscape shape us, that's all tied to memory in terms of how we engage in that landscape. So when we're engaged in a particular landscape, you know, especially a historical landscape, that helps us to understand the present.
The people shape the land. The land shapes the people. The past shapes the present. So what does Blair Mountain have to do with any of this? Mining has literally leveled some 500 mountains across Appalachia, changing local topography, hydrology, animal habitat, and environment. In turn, the land here, and coal, have molded the people, their economy, culture, and character, their very identity. The history locked in Blair Mountain's very soil could challenge some of the narratives around that identity. But right now, the closest place that grapples with that history is an hour away, at a small museum in the town of Matewan.
So that's where we are, at the entrance of the museum.
Wilma and Terry Steele helped found the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, along with Chuck Keeney. The Steeles are lifelong West Virginians with an intimate love of the land.
Terry and I both are old-type mountaineers. We love the mountains. Terry is a ginsenger, and I like to hunt mushrooms.
Terry was also a coal miner.
I worked underground for 26 years in Union.
Terry shows me around the museum. A poem by Carl Sandburg, inscribed on the wall, sets the tone.
It says, you live in a company house, you go to a company school, you work for this company, according to company rules. You all drink company water, and all use company lights. The company preacher teaches us what the company thinks is right.
A display holds coins produced by each mining company that functioned as currency, though it could only be used in their company stores.
Branch mining, or Fort Branch mining, I guess that's $1, right?
Yeah.
25 cents, Alma Fuel Company, Stone
Mountain.
Yeah,
some of them even has what you can buy with it, a loaf of bread or something stamped on it.
I see that right here, good for one loaf bread.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really controlling you.
As you walk through the museum, the displays chronicle various mine wars conflicts. One of them actually took place in this town. Then you get to the Blair Mountain section.
This here is a replica of one of the guns that would have been used on Blair. And these here are actually bullets that have been taken from Blair.
There's a harmonica, belt buckles, newspaper clippings detailing the battle, photos of miners. The museum successfully lays out a history visitors may not be familiar with. But this museum is far from Blair Mountain, the site of the big battle. I ask Terry, what might be different about visiting the mountain that he doesn't get at the museum?
I don't claim to know anything about the physical structure or where the battles took place on Blair. But I do know that what took place there is what's important to me. And that being that that's where my people, I'm talking about Union people, stood up against injustice, you know. And that's where they ran into injustice at. And some of them died there, you know, because of what they believe. Now that didn't happen here in this museum. No one has died in this museum. But when you're in the actual places where this takes place, it means more. I mean, there's a deeper connection, you know, I think with the soul, a deeper connection with the soul.
Terry, by the way, despite being from the area, despite the importance he places on Blair Mountain, despite this very personal history, has never been on the mountain. That's because it's pretty much all private land. It belongs to coal companies or their affiliates. For a long time, that meant not only that the land couldn't be visited, but also that it could actually be mined. Wanting to avoid that fate, in 2005, a coalition of various groups petitioned for Blair Mountain to be put on the National Register of Historic Places, to make sure it would not be blasted away. And in 2009, they succeeded. But pretty immediately, coal companies appealed the decision, and won. Soon after, they started applying for permits to mine Blair Mountain. The companies wanted to do mountaintop removal. That would involve dynamiting vast chunks of mountain to get to the coal seams. It would quite literally destroy Blair Mountain and the physical connection to its history.
Those in power decide what gets preserved and what stories are told about it, the ways in which the narrative is shaped. And those who don't have the power or resources are left out of the narrative. And often their sites are destroyed.
This is Allison James, the landscape architect again. Remember what Allison said earlier? The land shapes the people. The past shapes the present.
There are also political interests in the preservation of one place or another. Whose story are we telling? What effect might that have on the sense of power that might bring to the labor movement? Stories are powerful. So in that way, narrative is very, very much tied to landscape. And control over narrative is very much tied to landscape.
There's a narrative in West Virginia that coal has been a kind of godsend for the state, that it's provided work, money, pride, that it's brought nothing but good here, and its recession is something to mourn. But the people I spoke with want to complicate that narrative, to remind fellow West Virginians that coal also brought pain, that its extraction scarred both people and land. Chuck Keeney, the historian again.
Have to understand that you must be able to look at the natural world as something more than a commodity.
Telling the story of Blair Mountain also tells the story of bravery, of people who were willing to fight back, which flies in the face of this other narrative, of Appalachian fatalism, the persistent stereotype that people here are irreconcilably backward, lazy, passive in the face of poverty.
A big thing is casting ourselves in a more accurate light that'll change people's view of themselves, but also casting the region in a different light for the rest of the country. Having grown up here and lived here my whole life, I'm kind of sick of people making jokes about teeth and whether or not I'm barefoot or whether or not I'm dating my cousin, you know. And so this is a place where we can begin to reclaim our identity.
The land shapes the people. The past shapes the present. The Sierra Club, along with Chuck and a coalition of other groups, sued to put Blair Mountain back on the National Register of Historic Places. Chuck says working with the environmentalists was risky.
Being called an environmentalist here is kind of like, you know, being called a communist in the 1950s, okay? As soon as you have that label, nobody's going to listen to anything you have to say.
That's because many miners whose jobs have already become less secure as the industry first mechanized and then shrunk due to natural gas saw environmentalists as threatening their livelihoods.
So we had to focus on the history to win people over.
Chuck started to think of this fight as the second battle of Blair Mountain. Protecting the land became a matter of principle.
If they can destroy this place, which is the most sacred spot in the history of working class people, maybe in America, if they can destroy that and get away with wiping it off the map, then how can you stop them from anything else? How are you going to prevent the fossil fuel industry from heating up the planet if you can't stop them from blasting the one spot and destroying the one spot that is most crucial to working class history in America? If you can't stop them here, you can't stop them anywhere.
In 2016, a federal judge ruled that Blair Mountain had been removed improperly from the National Register of Historic Places, and eventually it was put back on the list. The designation protects the site from surface mining, but not necessarily from other disturbances, like timbering. And it doesn't solve the problem of people like Terry Steele not being able to visit the site, because the land is still in the hands of private companies. Chuck says he's worked with various philanthropic foundations willing to buy the land, but the coal companies are not selling. That hasn't stopped him from imagining what the land could be one day. He envisions a public park where people can come learn about the Battle of Blair Mountain, where they can see the entrenchments, can visualize the fighting. He thinks that might make people think differently about West Virginians, about labor, about coal.
I think the best history forces us to ask uncomfortable questions, and it forces us to confront uncomfortable truths, which is another reason why it's imperative to preserve this place. You can't be here without confronting some uncomfortable truths about the history of America, and so we must preserve it in order to confront those uncomfortable things. You can't move forward by teaching myths to your children. Right? You move forward as a civilization by debunking myths and confronting the hard truths.
For now, though, he sneaks behind the gate. If he comes alone, he'll often hear the gunshots from 100 years ago echoing in his mind.
But I don't always hear that. In spite of the fact that this was a place of violence, I don't know. I feel at peace when I'm up here. I don't know necessarily how to reconcile that or how to put it into words, but there it is.
For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhorov.